Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-13-5234, Hungate v. Rosen. Arguing for appellant, James J. Bickerton. Also appearing for appellant, John Francis Perkin, Stanley K. Rorig. Arguing for appellee Rosen, Christopher T. Glidden. Also appearing for appellee Rosen, David B. Rosen, Peter W. Olson. Arguing for appellee Deutsche Bank, Clyde J. Wadsworth. Also appearing for appellee Deutsche Bank, Judy A. Tanaka. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, counsel. Mr. Bickerton, Mr. Glidden, Mr. Wadsworth, are you all ready to proceed?
We are.
All right. And Mr. Bickerton, you've asked to reserve 12 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning light when you get that point in your argument. And my understanding is the appellees have split their time 15 and 15 minutes, so we'll have a warning light at 15 and 30 minutes for you. Mr. Bickerton, please proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice.
Good morning.
Honorable Justices, may it please this Court. It's fitting that we're gathered here today in this building to discuss the Hawaii non-judicial foreclosure statute. This building was opened in 1874. Aliulani Hale. In that same year, the legislature passed an Act 33 of the 1874 laws. That was the first non-judicial foreclosure statute. And it was a very terse statute. It consisted of four sections, which gave very little guidance to the court. It effectively did not prohibit anyone from selling a home on the top of Mount Haleakala at midnight, demanding payment in gold. I mean, there was very little restriction. And this law was a law that would control what is essentially the most major uprooting that a person can have. It's the loss of their home. And while these people who are subject to this law are in default and perhaps will lose their home anyway, they are still the owners of that home. A mortgage payment is not a rent.
Mr. Bickerton, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but since you're referring to ancient history, we have a rather old case here, the Ulrich case.
Yes.
Can you explain the extent, if at all, to which that would apply to the proposition that there's a claim against the mortgagor's attorney in this case? Because obviously Ulrich did recognize.
Justice Wilson, could you just pull the mic a little closer? I think folks are having a hard time hearing you. Thank you.
Were you able to hear my question?
Yes, I was.
Okay. And so I'm interested in the extent to which that would define any duty that would be applicable here between the mortgagee in this case, the mortgagee's attorney, and the mortgagor.
Well, thank you for asking that. I don't, interestingly enough, the defendant in that case was an attorney. But I don't think that really plays out here as being relevant. He was the mortgagee, and he was a law partner of the plaintiff. And he had used the non-judicial statute basically to acquire their partnership assets. The Ulrich case doesn't really speak to us about what the mortgagee's agent must do and what kind of duties the mortgagee's agent has to the mortgagor. But Ulrich does speak very directly in several different points to the duties that that the mortgagee has. And they're listed in our opening brief at pages 26 and 27. There's four quotes from the Ulrich case. But a very good example is, in the seizure of the property under the mortgages, defendant owed a duty to plaintiffs. That duty required him to use all fair and reasonable means in obtaining the best price for the property on sale.
And thank you. When you quote that language, are you referring to a duty of good faith and fair dealing that in some ways is different than a fiduciary duty? Is it a less of a duty than a fiduciary one?
The Ulrich Court actually addressed that. They said, we're not going to decide if this is a fiduciary duty or not. What they're saying is that it's very close to that. It may well be that, and I think they use phrases like trust-like or sufficiently similar to a trustee's duty. Now, I would note that many mainland courts have been express about saying that it is a fiduciary duty. And the Clem Court is one in the Washington State Supreme Court. But I'd like to read to you from the Wood River case, which is quoted in our reply memorandum in the Deutsche appeal. And it says, this duty is imposed upon the mortgagee foreclosing upon a power of sale. because the mortgagee is selling the property, and his interest is diametrically opposed to the interest of the mortgagor, especially if he is the purchaser of the property at the foreclosure sale. Now, that was the case here. Deutsche Bank was the credit bidder. In such case, the mortgagee is in a better position to hinder the sale and render it self-serving. The reasons for imposing such a duty are not present at a judicial foreclosure sale, because there the court, not the mortgagee, is selling the property. That quote really sums up why the duty has to be imposed. The duties that are laid out in Ulrich are, I don't know if we have to say that they are fiduciary to answer the questions in this case. They're defined duties. They're
Mr. Bickerton, the legislature has looked at the statute multiple times in recent years and has amended it, developed an alternate procedure. What's your response to the argument that this is an area that has been expressly addressed by the legislature in terms of what the obligations of the mortgagee are, and that we should not imply additional duties beyond those express ones?
Well, that is the analysis that Judge Mulway came up with in the Lima case, and that the case is a little bit sad because she didn't cite one single case in Lima to explain how she reached that. Judge Farris in the Gibbs case, which is cited, I believe, in the Deutsche appeal briefs, and then we added a Rule 28J letter to make sure that it was in the record in the Rosen appeal. The Gibbs case was expressly critical of that analysis because he said, Judge Farris said, the rule in Hawaii is if there's common law, and it's been established for, in this case, 100 years since Silva and over 80 or 70 years since Ulrich, it is not repealed unless the legislature expressly says that. So those cases remain in effect, and they apply to Part 1. What the legislature primarily tinkered with was Part 2. Part 2 still remains good law. In Part 2, they designed something to protect consumers, and they told the banks, if you follow Part 2, you cannot get sued for UDAP. They specifically put a safe harbor into Part 2. So yes, the legislature recognized those things, but I think also the legislature has recognized, for example, when they amended it the last time, they acknowledged Kekaoha, the federal case, where, again, Judge Farris, who seems to have taken the lead in analyzing and enforcing the statute, Judge Farris was upheld by the Ninth Circuit, and he found that conduct could be a UDAP in a foreclosure. So
that was against the bank.
That was against the bank, and I am prepared to address the attorney's liability if there's a specific question about that. But I did want to finish making a point with respect to Chief Justice's question. So it's very clear that these cases remain good law, and the simple reality is the legislature's tinkered with it but never put in any protections into Part 1 other than to say we want an attorney to do this because it had been abused. And in fact, they put a moratorium on Part 1. They put a moratorium on Part 1 in 2011 and then repealed it in 2012. I may have misspoken in the brief. I said it was repealed. I noticed I said we said it was repealed in 2011. But the point is, it was being abused. It was being used unfairly. And that's, one of the things that happened, I think, in front of Judge Mulway, and I regret we didn't argue harder, we spent a lot of time arguing about what does Ulrich mean and what does Silva mean and are those cases still good law. And we got away from the point, which is really at the center of this case, that is, you know, we're living in the 21st century. We have a consumer statute. The Compton case came down last year, and since one of the things they did in their briefs is they say, look at all these circuit judges who've ruled in our favor, as if that was somehow persuasive. But I'll tell you that since the Compton case came down, we've had over 5 of these motions to dismiss, and the bank has not won a single one of them. Because the judges now recognize that Judge Mulway's analysis is wrong. You don't look and see, did you violate the statute? If you didn't violate the foreclosure statute, it's not a UDAP. That's not the correct analysis. It's, did you violate the UDAP statute? Was it unfair or deceptive? Unfairness being measured by much broader and more general concepts such as public policy, the penumbra of public policy, in fact. That's how general the case law describes it. So you have to extract a public policy from different sources and say, is this public policy offended by what this bank did to this consumer? If the answer is yes, or even a jury could find that it is, there's a question of fact, and you go to trial. You don't get dismissed on a Rule 12.
Mr. Bickerton, you mentioned that we don't have to resort to finding a fiduciary, or hold that there's a fiduciary duty in order to find a duty to fairly conduct this sale. If we don't go with the fiduciary theory, how do we find liability against Mr. Rosen?
Well, I think that the first thing we can do is recognize that he is a sub-agent. That's a very important point. The bank is clearly, for purposes of the power of sale, Section 10 of the statute expressly recognizes that the bank is an agent. It makes sense. When we talk about a power of sale, where does this word power come from? It comes from the concept of power of attorney. And we cite a case, the Edna Cole case, that talks about the equivalence of those things. So what happens is someone has given a bank a power of attorney, in effect, to sell their home. We wouldn't have any trouble saying that bank, when it does that, not when it makes the loan, it's not their agent, but when it's selling their home at the end of this relationship, it's their agent for purposes of protecting their equity. There's a bunch of equity in that home, and the bank can't just sell it for willy-nilly and take its loan first and then leave the dregs for the mortgagor. So that duty is one that really can't be disputed, and it's an agency duty. The statute says you need to go get an attorney to carry this out. We don't want anyone doing this willy-nilly. We want licensed Hawaii attorneys doing it for you. That makes Mr. Rosen a sub-agent selling property to the public. And agents have fiduciary duties. So I think you can say that they are, some of the fiduciary duties are there. The duty that an agent has, duties of loyalty, of honesty, and using their diligent effort. The legislature has said that's a diligent effort to get the highest possible price, get the widest publicity. That was the 1890 legislature made that clear in Act 9 of the 1890 laws.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Bickerton.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Justice Pollack.
What about the Blair test?
I think every single test works. You can't get a clearer case than this. The Blair test, even before you get to Blair, there's some case law that says, if you're a third-party beneficiary of the engagement of the lawyer. Now, what is the bank engaging the lawyer to do? Sell the mortgagor's property, preserve his surplus, get the best price. Those are intended to benefit the mortgagor. Case law is all over clear that if you're hiring the lawyer not only to help you, but in a joint effort that helps someone else, that someone else can sue the lawyer. But I think the Blair test, if you go through the six-factor analysis, we lay that out in the brief, too. Again, it's the relationship. All they can say about Blair is they claim that the Boning case limited it to just to the wills and trusts situation. You can't read cases that narrowly. You must be able to extract some general principles from things. And Blair lays out a six-factor test, and it doesn't say, oh, but we're only going to apply this in probate cases.
Well, Mr. Bickerton, looking at Blair and the sixth factor, whether imposing liability placed an undue burden upon the legal profession, you have characterized the role of the attorney that is representing the lender or the bank as a sub-agent of the mortgagor. The mortgagee, excuse me. But in looking at this factor, would you say that there's an argument to be made that there could be something of an adversarial relationship, that is, between the attorney representing the bank and the mortgagee?
I would say
when there's a foreclosure action underway?
If I asked you if there are fish sitting in a barrel and you're shooting them, are they your adversary? That's really how this is. There's no judge. To have an adversary, you need a referee. You can't have the most powerful, wealthiest companies in America against people who are so broke that they can't pay their mortgage. No referee in the ring and say, well, they're adversaries, so we'll give Mr. Rosen a pass.
Would you then define the relationship between the counsel representing the mortgagor and the mortgagee differently? Would you define the relationship differently if it was a judicial foreclosure?
Absolutely. There it is an adversarial proceeding. We recognize that we arrive at justice by having true adversaries, but with a referee in the middle. And when we remove the referee, it changes the relationship and the duties change. That's the key thing. And what happens to so many judges who hear these cases, they just hear the word foreclosure, and they're very familiar with judicial foreclosure and the protections there. They don't realize this is not foreclosure. This is one guy selling another guy's house for the both of them. That's what it boils down to.
Mr. Bickerton, while my example is not as colorful as yours is shooting fish in a barrel, what struck me about defining this as an adversarial, if it was truly adversarial, shouldn't the bank and their agent selling, wouldn't they, their greatest interest being, rather than continue just, well, how many times you keep continuing the auction, 4, 5, 10 times, as you said, have it on Haleakala. In other words, if it's truly adversarial, if that's really what their objective is, then they're going to get the amount of money that will advantage the bank the most, get rid of all possible bidders, and be able to buy the property back at the least amount so they can sell it at the greatest amount. So if we're really talking about an adversarial relationship, which normally is what you have when you're trying to protect the attorney-client relationship, that would be the objective. And I'm not sure that that's how these are supposed to work out.
Well, that is our position, that they're not supposed to work out that way. That is actually what Judge Farris, when he said, I don't know these, in Gibbs, he says, I don't know the full extent of that rule, but there must be some restriction. Otherwise, banks could do that. They could bid a dollar, no one else shows up, and then turn around and sell it for $1 million and keep all the money. And there's no way that can happen. So where do the protections come? I want to, again, refocus the court on Chapter 480, because this question of Blair, for example, those questions, Blair and whether there are duties and all those questions, they go to the common law wrongful foreclosure claim that we've alleged. The question of whether or not Mr. Rosen participated in the UDAP, I would like to draw your attention to the Davis versus Wholesale Motors case, and in particular, in that case, the case cited by the ICA. How did they conclude that the unclean hands defense, which does apply to a lot of claims, does not apply to a UDAP claim? They said we're following Permilife. Permilife is a U.S. Supreme Court antitrust case. Section 3 of Chapter 480 says you must look to antitrust cases to figure out things about the UDAP law. And that's what they did. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. And Permilife says we will not automatically apply common law rules to UDAP cases. What we will do is we will analyze whether they are consistent or inconsistent with the underlying policies of the antitrust statute. That analysis has to be done here. Is it consistent with the underlying policies of the UDAP statute to give Mr. Rosen immunity when he's acting not in court, but in the public marketplace, selling people's homes to the public, advertising them to the public? Is it consistent with the consumer statute's policies to give him immunity? We say no, and the legislature didn't confer it.
Mr. Bickerton, would you talk about, with regard or vis-a-vis Mr. Rosen, was the Mr. Hungate a consumer of his services, and how would the trade or commerce requirement be satisfied, again, with regard to Mr. Rosen's
Well,
conduct?
He is not a consumer directly of Mr. Rosen's services, but we've got three cases that say agents are liable. Letitia Query, the buyer was not consuming her services and the realtor's services in that case. Fuller Brush, there was an agent of the Fuller Brush Company agent was sued, and then in Eastern Star, corporate officers were sued. There was no privity or direct relationship. So that's not necessary. And then Flores came along and said, look, a collection agency can be sued even though the consumer never consumed anything from the collection agency, but the collection agency was acting for the original entity that made the loan. And that's what Mr. Rosen is doing. He's helping out the bank, which is the successor in interest to the original lender, stands in the shoes of the original lender. So the Flores case, between the Flores case, Eastern Star, the Fuller Brush case, and the Letitia Query case, we have a whole long line of cases that say agents are liable too, even though they don't have direct privity or dealings of a consumer nature with the plaintiff.
But Mr. Bickerton, you referred to Mr. Rosen as a mere business agent. how does the fact that the statute requires the mortgagee to hire an attorney who's licensed to practice law play into your description of things in your business?
Well, I think what I was trying to make the point was the statute imposed no new duties. In 2007, before they amended the statute to say that the agent had to be a lawyer, anyone could do it. And when in 2008 they said, okay, a lawyer's got to do it, they didn't change the duties. So those are duties that historically and for over 100 years were considered and labeled the duties of a business agent. So my point is that if you are going to carve out something the legislature didn't put in, which is a distinction between certain areas of practice of law that are immune from UDAP scrutiny and other areas, you wouldn't draw the line here where the lawyer has stepped outside of the courtroom, outside of the advice role, and is actively operating in the marketplace doing the things that business agents have done for 100 years. If you're going to draw a line, Mr. Rosen will be outside that protection. That is the point that we were making, I think, in the briefs. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there are other questions.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Bickerton. And we'll hear from Mr. Gooden.
May it please the court. This case has broad implications for lenders, lenders' attorneys, and all attorneys who assist their clients in transactions. This is the first in a group of several cases to be set for oral argument. All those cases are pending on appeal. All of the cases involve defaulted mortgagors asserting claims against attorneys who assisted their clients in the non-judicial foreclosure process.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but thank you for bringing up that point. And can you just define how you see the relationship between the lender's attorney in this case and the lender of the bank? In other words, would you characterize that as an attorney-client relationship? And if so, why is that?
As between the lender and the lender's attorney, it is, in fact, an attorney-client relationship. And that fact is specifically alleged in the complaint.
And how do you respond to the notion that was acting more as sort of a business agent and not in the capacity as an attorney?
Well, Mr. Rosen and his law office was definitely acting as counsel for the bank. He was retained to conduct a non-judicial foreclosure, and that was part of his practice of law. The practice of law is essentially, I believe this court said in the Fott case, defined in the inverse, that an attorney can engage in a task that can also be covered by a non-attorney. A good example would be debt collection or accountants. But when the attorney does it, the attorney is also able to represent the client as an attorney, to advise the client as an attorney. And so therefore, the relationship is far more than just a mere business agent, but rather an attorney-client relationship, and that is what was alleged in this case, that Mr. Rosen was retained to act on behalf of the bank.
You used as an example debt collection. Isn't that one of the big exceptions that allow these kind of claims that the plaintiffs are trying to bring in this case?
So, Your Honor, this is not asserted as a debt collection case.
No, I understand, but your example, even your assertions, I mean, there's certain exceptions that exist. I mean, there's the fraud, misrepresentation, there's the beneficiary, negligent drawing of Blair. Isn't this something similar where we have somebody who's the homeowner who's a beneficiary of that option?
Your Honor, this is not similar to the exceptions to the general rule limiting attorney liability. The exceptions are, as you said, fraud or the holding of money had and received, as in the Brown versus Judd case, or there could be a third-party beneficiary circumstance, but that was in the Blair case, and subsequently in Busher versus Boning, this court limited that rule to the estate planning context expressly, saying that there was no duty in that circumstance, and that case involved the drawing up of a settlement agreement. And in Busher versus Boning, this court addressed two claims.
I would say it distinguished it. I'm not exactly say it limited it only to that. It said that. So I'm not sure that that holding said it's not going to be applicable in those situations.
Your Honor, I don't believe that the Blair test, even if it were to apply beyond the estate planning context, would apply in this case. Let me ask you,
can the bank, when it's doing the auction, continue it 10, 15 times, have it any time at night, and, you know, every time somebody shows up, they say, oh, we don't want another bidder, they can just postpone it again? I mean, under your theory, it seems like there's no duty whatsoever.
Your Honor, there is absolutely a duty on the part of the bank with respect to the mortgagor. And that duty is to comply with the terms of the nonjudicial foreclosure statute. The legislature has specifically...
What about the terms of the power of sale within the contract?
Absolutely. I was right about to say that, Your Honor. Those two things. Those are the sources of the mortgagee's duties. And in this case, we don't have to look farther than those sources because the challenged conduct at issue is specifically spoken to by the nonjudicial foreclosure statute. Those two activities are the initial scheduling of the sale. It's at 4 weeks. 4 weeks, we're done.
I'm sorry. So addressing that issue then, looking at that statute, it says the sale can take place, the proposed sale can take place at any time after the expiration of 4 weeks from the date when first advertised. So if the date when first advertised was the first, the statute says that 28 days must expire from that date, which would be the 29th. Then the sale can take place thereafter. So therefore, the sale could not take place until the 30th. Would you agree? I understand you do not agree with that. You think that the sale can take place on the 29th.
Well, I would say that just to make it very concrete, Your Honor, the first date of publication here was on March 20th.
Let's just assume the first. It's much easier to calculate that way.
That date is counted within the 4th week period. The statute specifically looks...
It says after the expiration of 4 weeks from the date. So the from the date, 4 weeks has to expire.
Right. And
so 28 days have to expire after the first. So that would be at the end of the 29th, so the sale could not take place until the 30th.
I disagree, Your Honor. I believe that date is counted within it, and that is consistent with all of this court's cases in counting days. If we look at the Silva case and we count according to the formula in Silva, the first day is counted within the period. If we look at the Weidemann case that was cited, I believe, in the reply brief in the Deutsche appeal, that first day in the notice is counted. If we look at how this court has counted the days, it counts. And even if we apply Section 1-29, as the plaintiff has suggested, the first day is counted. It's analogous to giving notice, 18 days notice before a hearing in court. It's the same type of formula. When you apply that type of rule of construction, you count the date of the hearing, or here the date of the sale, and you just count backwards. And if we do that, the 4 weeks were...
The language is quite different in Silva. First giving 3 weeks notice. It doesn't have that expiration of 28 days from the date of the first publication.
The language is exactly the same in the Weidemann case that this court decided.
Okay.
It was, I believe, an after expiration case.
Well, you're on the issue of the import of the mortgage itself. Could you help me with the notion of the implied duty or an implied condition of good faith and fair dealing? Looking at the Ulrich case, would there be an implied condition in the mortgage between the bank and, in this case, the mortgagor?
Your Honor, I believe that, as with all contracts in Hawaii, mortgage is a contract. The parties do not engage in bad faith.
So help me with that. Why is it that, in this case, the continuance of the foreclosure took place, and wouldn't that be something that could be at least considered as a fact showing a violation of a duty of good faith and fair dealing?
Well, Your Honor, I would give two responses to that. The first is that here it couldn't be a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, or a UDAP for that matter, because our non-judicial foreclosure statute prescribed a procedure for postponing auctions, and that was by public announcement. That's my first.
So well, as many public announcements as you want is okay, under your theory?
It complies with the statute, Your Honor. That is our position.
Okay. And so there's no responsibility so that the person who's auctioning, as you say, can look at and just, oh, there's too many bidders. Let's postpone it.
Your Honor, I believe that would factor in an issue of bad faith.
Okay. In the affidavit, is there anything in the affidavit that was filed after the foreclosure that explains why there were so many postponements?
There is not, Your Honor. I reviewed the affidavit.
And doesn't the statute require an explanation of the full activity?
Sorry, Your Honor. Full activity?
Well, it says, I think when the affidavit is... shall file a copy of the notice and the mortgage, setting forth the mortgage's acts and the premises fully and particularly. In other words, you're supposed to set forth what you've done in the affidavit, having to do with it.
And that condition was satisfied in this case, Your Honor.
Well, the affidavit shows, I believe, one announcement, not four.
Actually, Your Honor, the full affidavit and all the attachments explain each announcement. And in the notices, it says that at each postponed auction, a public announcement was made, and the auction was continued accordingly to the new date. So there is a very detailed explanation as to what Your Honor said, what was done. That was done in this case.
Why were they continued?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Why were they continued?
It doesn't explain why, and I don't believe that the statute requires to explain why, whether it was because the mortgagor.
The statute may not require, but what if it was in bad faith? Come back to, I think you had conceded that if it was postponed in order to come back on another date when there were fewer bidders, that that would go to bad faith. So shouldn't we imply an obligation to have the affidavit explain what the circumstances were, or wouldn't that obligation be one that good faith would require?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that that was not alleged as an underlying theory in this case, and I don't believe it was argued on appeal as to what the why for the auction being postponed. I believe that their argument is that just you couldn't postpone at all, that you needed to publish. So really, that argument wasn't made below.
Well, isn't this a 12B6?
It is, Your Honor.
Failure to state, I mean, aren't we supposed to assume that everything in the complaint is true and that there's no way, there's no plausible theory of liability
Your Honor,
whatsoever?
It is also what is alleged in the complaint. And if they're alleging that it was for a certain rationale that the auction was postponed, then that has to be alleged.
Okay. Well, getting back to the 12B6 issue, in addition, this is not just a UDAP claim, correct? There's clearly at least an unfair competition claim.
There is an unfair competition claim, Your Honor, that's been asserted, but our position is that all of those claims failed because there was no violation.
Okay.
With respect to the underlying conduct, the two acts challenged in this case of continuing and initially scheduling.
Okay, what about that paragraph of the mortgage that says, lender shall publish a notice of sale and shall sell the property at the time and place and under the terms specified in the notice of sale. It seems to me what I hear being argued is that you're reading out a portion of that, because the way you're reading this, it says, lender shall publish a notice of sale and shall sell the property under the terms specified in the notice of the sale. In other words, you're reading right out of it the time and place, because under your theory, the terms include the time and place.
Well, the terms speak to postponements, and this refers to the notice of sale which is initially given. So there's an initial notice of sale, you publish it three times, and the time and place.
Do you sell the property under the terms? Are the terms, the time and place, the terms of the sale?
It does include that, Your Honor, and that is what Judge Wallach included in the lien.
I understand what she concluded. I understand you listed that as a term, but this is in the mortgage document, and your notice doesn't trump the mortgage document, and the mortgage document says that it's sold it under the terms.
And one of those terms is that the auction may be postponed by public announcement, and that is
completely. Is that a term consistent of the sale, or a term, or the procedure for conducting the auction?
Well, it's one of the terms of the sale.
Would that be included in the contract? Is it a term of the sale? I mean, would it be in the sales contract? You know, I mean, is it a term that would be in the sales contract?
As between mortgagee and the purchaser.
As between the mortgagee and the purchaser at the public auction? Is it a term of the sale?
I don't know if that was a term of the sale, Your Honor. That document is not.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to get back to that issue of other claims that may be alleged in this complaint, 12B6. Clearly, there is a 480 unfair competition claim stated.
Yes, Your Honor.
But this is a notice pleading state, and it appears that they also allege, you know, wrongful acts as above. I think this court has also stated that the common law tort of unfair competition has not been affected by the promulgation of the statute. Now, and I think it's pretty clear that under agency law, agents are liable for the torts, for their own torts, even if their principals may be vicariously liable. So in terms of a 12B6 dismissal, how can we say that there's no claim that survives under a 12B6 standard here?
Because Mr. Rosen, it is undisputed, was acting as an attorney within the scope of the attorney-client relationship with his client, the mortgagee in this case.
So as long as an attorney is acting for a client, if the attorney commits fraud, deceit, intentional misrepresentation, or negligent misrepresentation, that attorney can never be held liable in tort to the third party they're dealing with?
That is not what I'm saying, Your Honor. Fraudulent misrepresentation was not alleged in this case. And if I could just briefly see my time.
You can certainly answer the question.
Yes. I would refer the court to the case of Reynolds versus Schrock, which this court discussed at length in the Kahala Royal case and quoted its holding with approval. And that case, just very briefly, involved a situation where the Oregon Supreme Court explained that ordinarily a person is liable for assisting another in breaching the other's fiduciary duties. And in that case involved a settlement agreement for the disposition of real property. But the Oregon Supreme Court explained that a different rule applies when that person is an attorney, and that imposing liability on the attorney would divide the attorney's loyalties, would subject the attorney to a conflict of interest, and ultimately undermine our legal system.
Is it your position that the duties, the standard in 667.10 just does not apply to this case, or that it was waived because it wasn't specifically argued?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the duties.
I think, you know, the 667.10 says that when the mortgagee sells the transferred property as attorney or agent of the mortgage or under a power of sale. So it appears that this statute does suggest that in exercising a power of sale, there is an attorney or agent status of the mortgagee. And I'm just wondering, I think your brief said this doesn't apply because they didn't argue it. Or are you saying that it just doesn't apply?
I'm saying both, Your Honor. I believe 667.10 as a theory was not asserted before Judge Nishimura, so she had no occasion to rule on it, and therefore I don't think it's a proper thing to raise on appeal. It's not fair to the trial judge. It also doesn't apply for three quick reasons, if I could. I know I'm cutting into my time. But one, the statute concerns the transfer of the property. There's no transfer in this case which would invoke the statute. Two,
it says no sale or transfer. That's what the statute says.
Correct. If there's a sale, then it doesn't affect the power of sale, is what it's saying. So I'm saying the statute doesn't even come into play because there was no transfer in the first instance. On top of that, it speaks to an agent or power of attorney, but ultimately that just begs the question, what's stated in the mortgage? And if we look to the mortgage here, there's nothing about a power of attorney, so there's no fiduciary relationship established by the mortgage in terms of a power of attorney.
The mortgage trumps the statute?
It does not, Your Honor. All I'm saying is the statute refers to a right or power of attorney, so that simply begs the question of what's actually in the mortgage. And we have the mortgage here, and it doesn't create any type of power of attorney in the mortgagor. And my third response is it speaks to, if at all, a relationship between the mortgagor and the mortgagee, not to the mortgagee, I should say the mortgagor and the mortgagee's attorney. It definitely does not speak to that situation. Reynolds versus Schrock does. And specifically in that case, it involved a fiduciary duty, a breach of that duty regarding the disposition of real property under settlement agreement. So again, I would refer the court to that case. My time is expired.
Thank you very much, Mr. Green. We'll hear from Mr. Wadsworth at this point.
May it please the court. Plaintiff is saying in this appeal that a mortgagee can comply with the specific procedures set out in the nonjudicial foreclosure statute for giving notice, but still be held liable under the more general UDAP statute for not giving what plaintiff considers after the fact to be more or better notice. Respectfully, that can't be the law. It can't be that a mortgagee does what the legislature tells it to do for a nonjudicial foreclosure, but is still exposed to liability for not following notice procedures that plaintiff dictates after the fact, particularly where there is no established public policy that imposes those duties or procedures on the mortgagee.
Well, now, thank you for talking about public policy, because maybe you can help us with the policy that was involved in the continual changing of the date for the sale. Now, you've suggested that that's, as a matter of law, I think, good public policy because it complies with the statute. But in the event that that is being used as a tactic to cause the sale to be at a depressed price that would be to the disadvantage of the mortgagee, then wouldn't you concede that at least that's against public policy to manipulate the practice that is described both in the statute and the mortgage?
Well, Your Honor, here the allegation is that the sale was postponed four times.
Well, I understand you're probably taking the position, and it may well be a position that would be correct according to a fact finder, but you're taking the position that under these facts there's no indication of a violation of public policy. I'm just trying to take you through the point that you were making about public policy, and if there's an implied condition of good faith and fair dealing that's part of the relationship between the mortgagee and the mortgagor, and if so...
Well.
Yeah,
yes,
shouldn't that
yes,
be...
Yes, Your Honor, as counsel stated, we agree that in every contract there is a covenant of good faith and fair dealing. The mortgage is a contract. There is a covenant of good faith and fair dealing
if that covenant's being violated because of the manipulation of the timing of the auction, then in theory would you concede that there'd be a claim?
I suppose it's possible under certain circumstances, Your Honor, but those aren't the circumstances that are alleged here.
How do we know?
Why not? Because the allegation is that the auction was postponed four times. It's not unusual for a foreclosure mortgage or a foreclosure auction to be postponed. The statute itself.
What if the contract?
Multiple postponements.
What if I agree, that's what the statute says, but would you agree that under our case law, the mortgage itself can provide further rights, additional rights to a mortgagor?
I agree that the mortgagee must comply with the...
So it depends on how we construe paragraph 22 and the provision that says that the sale shall take place at the time and place indicated in the notice.
Right. I would remind the court, though, on that point that the paragraph 15 of the mortgage also expressly states that, quote, if any notice required by the security instrument is also required by applicable law, the applicable law requirement will satisfy the corresponding requirement under the security agreement. So in the case of a notice of sale, which is required both under the mortgage and under HRS 667-5, the mortgage itself states that if you comply apply to the 667-5 who satisfy the mortgage.
What is the bank's position as to whether or not Ulrich is still good law or not?
Well, Ulrich, as Judge Mulway stated in the Lima, Gibo, and Ball decisions, and is also Judge Kobayashi agreed with her in the Sigler case. Ulrich is a chattel mortgage case. The ruling in Ulrich did not apply to
So there should be lower standards for real property sales of people's homes then?
I'm not saying that there should be lower standards, Your Honor. If we're asking, though, whether Ulrich set the standard for the non-judicial foreclosure of real property, the answer is no. And the ruling with respect to chattel mortgages has been superseded by the UCC. So Ulrich doesn't give us doesn't establish a public policy in this case. I mean, plaintiff talks about and he just argued about inferring a public policy from penumbras in the law, penumbras, shadows. With all due respect, if you're going to hold mortgagees, if this court is going to hold mortgagees liable for conduct that complies with the non-judicial foreclosure statute, it should be based on more than shadows in the law. Ulrich does not apply to non-judicial foreclosure of real property, and it didn't set the standard. Here,
Ulrich doesn't apply to non-judicial foreclosures?
Foreclosures of real property. It applied to a chattel mortgage.
They were both in the same statute until very recently. The chattels, both of them were in the same statute. There's never been a case holding that I'm aware of the Hawaii courts that said Ulrich was only limited, and that was the only precedential effect.
If you're talking about in the federal case law, obviously there has been a holding.
I have seen that in the federal decisions, and I've seen federal decisions going the other way as well.
I would point out, Your Honor, that at least in a non-published decision of this court in 2006, the court specifically.
I'm sorry, but that's you can't even cite that under our rules.
Well, I'm not citing it for a proposition of law, Your Honor, an affirmative proposition of law. I just want to point out that the issue of
the rule 35C is very clear. Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure, you cannot cite unpublished dispositions before July 1st of 2007.
All right, Your Honor. I apologize that, I wasn't trying to cite for an affirmative proposition of law. But the argument that I'm making here is that there is no published case authority that specifically imposes the duties on the mortgagee in a non-judicial foreclosure of real estate that the plaintiff attempts to impose here. The plaintiff takes snippets.
So what do you think the duty should be then of a mortgagee under a non-judicial foreclosure?
The duties of a mortgagee under a non-judicial foreclosure are to follow the foreclosure statute and to follow the requirements of the
mortgage. So is it also your position, as argued by Mr. Gooden, that there's no limit to the number of times you can continue the foreclosure auction?
I think at some point under certain circumstances, it's possible that would implicate the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Well, why isn't that alleged in the complaint? We have to read this. I mean, the allegations in the complaint says the public policy under the law permitting oral announcements of the postponement are to take place as soon as possible so as not to lose the attention gained by the original publication. And then it goes on and talks about how only a single bidder showed up as a result. I mean, why isn't there sufficient allegations on the complaint?
Because under 667-5D, which reflects the relevant public policy, Your Honor, it states that any sale, quote, may be postponed from time to time by public announcement, unquote. So the legislature itself contemplated and authorized multiple postponements by public announcement.
Without reason.
Pardon me?
Without any reason. In other words, the reason could be based simply on the fact that there was too many bidders for the bank's liking.
That's that's not the allegation here, but we have to assume that if the legislature authorized multiple postponements, and if encouraging competitive bidding was one of the purposes of HRS 667-5, as this court stated in the Lee case, then we have to assume that the legislature intended that the notice procedures that it set out in 667-5, that it satisfied any duty regarding competitive bidding.
But Mr. Wadsworth, you yourself said there's a limit. You can't just keep, the mortgagee cannot continue to postpone it. Didn't you say previously there is a limit? And so you could still be in compliance with the statute.
What I said was, under certain circumstances, I can imagine that a mortgagee could violate a duty of good faith and fair dealing.
And still comply with the statute.
In the mortgage. Pardon?
And still be in compliance with the statute.
Well,
Mr. Wadsworth, would you speak into the microphone? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
People won't be able to hear you.
Your Honor. No. They may very well not be in compliance with the statute. It's a very sparse hypothetical. I mean, if the mortgagee has delayed the auction 100 times, I suspect there may be other circumstances behind that that a plaintiff or mortgagor might allege.
Were there any allegations here beyond the fact that it was continued four times? Anything else to indicate that there was something untoward or unfair about the process, or is that your position there was simply the four continuances without more?
It was simply the four continuances. For example, there's no allegation here that the oral public announcements weren't made. Distinguishes this case from the Gibbs case.
You finish your answer.
That distinguishes this case in part from the Gibbs case and Judge Ferris's decision that counsel favors. In that case, the allegation regarding postponements was that oral announcements were not given, and that is not the allegation here.
Well, in the course of making a determination at the circuit court level, where was the presumption to be factually in terms of entertaining this motion to dismiss? In other words, if you have a set of facts that might be construed in a manner that would support the cause of action under that factual scenario, wouldn't it be error to enter a motion to grant a motion to dismiss in this case?
I believe that the court determined as a matter of law that the procedures that the mortgagee followed in this case were the procedures that were set out in the statute, and therefore the legislature could not have intended them to be unfair and deceptive.
In other words, under the set of facts as alleged, there couldn't possibly be a legal claim, correct?
Correct.
But in making that analysis, then, as I think Justice McKenna was alluding to, the factual presumption would be in favor of the non-moving party. And in this case, you've just outlined, I think, a factual scenario in which perhaps there could be a claim if the continuing of the sale was done in a way that was in bad faith. So we have four different continuances. The record doesn't have an explanation other than that scenario as to why they were continued. So why wouldn't the duty of the circuit court be to move, if you follow me, in the direction of a presumption in favor of the non-moving party, that maybe that would constitute a claim?
Because the statute itself authorizes multiple continuances, and there's nothing in the allegations in the complaint beyond the fact that there were four continuances to suggest some bad faith that would violate the mortgage.
Excuse me, because after the part that I just read, which talks about the continuances and how it was against the public policy so that it would be soon after the published date so as to not lose the attention gained by the original publication, the complaint goes on, and then it says As a result, the winning bid was $161,000. This sum was substantially below the market value of the property. And then it says that that the conduct violated Chapter 667 because it breached the power of sale to give. And then the conduct of
Justice Bach, could you come by the mic? I'm sorry.
And the conduct of the defendant, as aforesaid, chilled the bidding at the public auction of the property, thereby violating the public policy. I'm not sure how much more specific the allegations in the complaint could have been.
Well, as I stated, Your Honor, this court recognized in Lee that one of the purposes of 667-5 is to encourage competitive bidding. That was one of the purposes that the legislature had in mind in drafting the statute.
How does continual continuances fulfill that purpose?
The statute. There are other purposes in the statute as well, but the statute specifically authorizes multiple continuances.
Well, one could imagine that there would be a continuance in order to achieve a higher bid if nobody showed up. Right, you'd want, in that sense, it would be a great benefit to continue it in the hopes that somebody would show up the next time to enter a bid.
There are many possible explanations for
but given the
sometimes it's because there's
sure.
no negotiation going on with the mortgagor about paying off the debt.
There are some good reasons, but the flavor of the record, and I'm certainly interested in your view of the record, but the flavor of the record, as suggested by Justice Pollack, doesn't seem to be one where there was necessary to continue it so you could have some bidders.
The record is the First Amendment complaint, and the First Amendment complaint states that the auction was postponed four times.
And the accomplishment of the four continuances was to end up with one bidder.
Well, that's speculation. That's a conclusion. That's what
the complaint. We have to accept the allegation, the complaint, that there's one bidder.
But Your Honors don't have to, and the Circuit Court doesn't have to accept conclusions and speculation. There's nothing in the complaint. There are no facts stated that specifically relate the four.
Does the complaint state, because we have to accept the allegations of the complaint as true in a 12b6 motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. So does the complaint state that the continuances were because we were trying to negotiate a refi? Does the complaint state that the reason for the continuances was because there was nobody at the first one and the lender was trying to get more people at future sales?
Your Honor, I would submit that it's the plaintiff's duty in the complaint to state a claim and state causation to his damages.
He stated that as a result there was only one buyer and the property was sold for $161 when he had bought it for $370 or $380.
And the plaintiff has an obligation, though, to go beyond conclusions and speculation. He has to state facts that are able to establish causation. And here, Your Honor, I don't think he does that. He states a result. He states what his criticisms are of the notice procedures, and then he states the result. He doesn't plead facts that relate that result specifically to the procedures that he's complaining about.
What was the identity of the buyer?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Who was the buyer of this property?
The buyer was the mortgagee.
I mean, some might interpret that to be a fact that would be useful, I suppose, to infer that the tactic here was to let the number of bidders decline to the point where the bank could buy it. I mean, I'm not suggesting that the record necessarily shows that, but as you go through the point of saying that there are no facts that
Your Honor,
are part of this record, that seems to be a fact.
Your Honor, one of the purposes of the nonjudicial foreclosure statute that this court identified in the Lee case was that It's supposed to give creditors a quick and inexpensive remedy against defaulting creditors. That's one of the purposes of the statute.
That policy trump everything else?
No, but if the court doesn't look at the allegations of the complaint to see if there are any factual allegations that actually support causation, in case like this, you could possibly infer some kind of ulterior motive when there's a credit bid. That can't be enough.
No, that may not be enough.
The court has to look beyond conclusions and speculation.
Isn't that what discovery is for?
Well, then we don't have an inexpensive and quick remedy anymore.
What do you think a mortgagee's duty is? I don't think you actually responded to my question.
I'm sorry, I thought I did, Your Honor. Okay. A mortgagee's duty is to follow the foreclosure statute.
That's it. No duty to try to get the best price. None whatsoever.
I don't believe, Your Honor.
No duty whatsoever to the mortgagor. None whatsoever.
There is no published authority in this jurisdiction that imposes that duty on the mortgagee. I think that the argument here that the mortgagor, the plaintiff, has made may make a compelling argument from his snippets that there should be such a duty. But that's not an established policy, Your Honor.
Even if you disagree that whether or not Ulrich applies, which obviously we have to examine, you don't think that there's any duty, even under the standard duty of good faith and fair dealing. That would, in and of itself, our case law on the duty of good faith and fair dealing in every contract, you don't think even that would create any duty for the mortgagee?
I didn't say that, Your Honor. I said there's no duty in the case law to get the best possible price, which is the duty that the plaintiff here imposes.
What does good faith and fair dealing mean then?
It means that the mortgagee has to follow its obligations under the mortgage in good faith. With respect to price, there hasn't been any authority on that point. Judge Ferris, again, the plaintiff favors, in the Gibbs case, Judge Ferris himself said, "Well, I don't know what there is, but there must be some duty regarding price."
You're not suggesting that those cases, those decisions, are binding on this court, are you?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that this is further evidence of the fact that there's no established policy. There have to be more than shadows in the law. There has to be an established policy that conflicts with or imposes a different notice standard there has to be more than snippets from the law. There has to be an established policy, and here there isn't one. There isn't a case, there isn't common law authority that imposes on the mortgagee in the nonjudicial foreclosure of real property a duty regarding price.
Well, let me ask you, if I might, about that relationship between the mortgagor and the mortgagee. Now, you've described it in the context of nonjudicial foreclosure. Would the relationship be any different if there was a judicial foreclosure, in your view? The relationship between the mortgagor and the mortgagee?
I believe it's adversarial in both contexts, Your Honor.
In both, okay. And so would it be the same in your view?
Would it be the same?
Yeah, the relationship between the mortgagee and the mortgagor in nonjudicial and judicial foreclosure.
I'm not certain, Your Honor, of all the implications of what the duties are in judicial foreclosure, so I can't answer that question.
Mr. Wadsworth, anything else to wrap up at this time?
Yes.
Briefly.
Briefly in conclusion, Your Honors. Even if there's a duty regarding price obtained at a nonjudicial foreclosure, even if that duty exists, where the mortgagee has complied with specific notice procedures set out in the nonjudicial foreclosure statute, a general duty regarding price still can't displace or override the statute's prescribed specific procedures with plaintiff's preferred procedures. Again, encouraging competitive bidding, that was a purpose of 667-5 under the Lee case. We have to assume that the legislature intended that the specific notice procedures as set out in 667-5 satisfy any duty regarding competitive bidding.
Thank you very much. Now we'll hear again from Mr. Bickerton in rebuttal.
Thank you. A concern I have is that this court may find that, we'll just go with the good faith and fair dealing duty and apply that. Really, that's a vaguer. They're complaining that the standard I'm proposing, what we are proposing in this appeal, is too vague and people will get sued for all kinds of things. But that one is even vaguer, and it has limits, too, that don't really make much sense. I think for them to stand up here and say, there's no expression of public policy. You can read the preamble of this statute. In 1890, the legislature said, the true intent and object of this statute and of any law to provide for foreclosure of mortgages without suit ought to be to reduce expenses and outlay to the mortgagor, that's the one he made sure he mentioned, while giving the widest publicity to the sale of the mortgaged premises in order to obtain the greatest possible price. There is no clearer way to find the public policy behind a statute than to look at the law that adopted it and the preamble where the legislature says, here's why we're adopting it.
But the legislature then specifically adopts the procedure which was followed here. So why would we imply a duty beyond, or what would the basis be for implying a duty beyond the specific process the legislature adopted here?
Let me say this about the legislature. The legislature is adopting these laws and procedures as a floor, and they are doing that in the context of knowing that this court puts other rules in place. So, for example, in the 20s or 30s when they said you can have oral postponement. In the Great Depression, there was a lot of foreclosures, and perhaps people didn't want to, I don't know how that law got passed or why, but that was the floor. They made it clear in Sylvan and Ulrich, you can provide for more in the power of sale, and they did. In this case, they did. We've done that analysis of paragraph 22, and I won't use up too much time here, but I think Justice Pollack understood our argument very well with his questions. So you can have more, but there's another thing that happened in Ulrich. They said you didn't do what was customary. That's what they told the defendant in that case. Yes, you complied with the bare minimum of the statute, but you didn't do what is customary. Now, what was customary at that time was that the notice wasn't really the ad. That's become something that's evolved over time. The notice is as put in the paper as the ad. But in those days, there would be a notice, and there would be separate advertisements through flyers or posters. And that was the custom in the community. And the lawyer defendant, the guy who was taking his partner's law practice away through the foreclosure, he didn't do that. And the court said, you know, so what? He argued exactly what these folks are arguing here today. Well, we complied with the statute. The court said, you didn't do your duty, your common law duty. You're supposed to try to get the best price. The way that's customarily done is put a few ads out. So your compliance with the statute doesn't help you. Now, we have, since Ulrich, we have a consumer statute on top of that. That one is very clear. The legislature came and said, you know what? You will be in compliance with the consumer statute if you publish the postponement and orally announce it. That's what the legislature told the banks. You want the protection from UDAP? Go under Part 2. Section 28 of Part 2 says you must both publish and announce.
Mr. Orally. Bickerton, the argument – I'm sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you. Argument here is the only allegations we have are four postponements, only one bidder, and a sale price substantially below the market value. Do you agree with that characterization of the complaint, and why are those allegations enough to implicate the duty that you're arguing for here?
Well, first of all, we, we don't agree with that because there's much more to it. We say the original notice was defective. One of the paragraphs, we point out that a reasonable consumer, paragraph 55, the language of paragraph 22 would lead the ordinary consumer to believe his property is going to be sold on the date in the notice. And we point out through the factual record we presented to the judge that 80% of Mr. Rosen's auctions do not happen on that date. So right out of the gate, the notice is misleading. And presumably the people who customarily come down to these auctions, they're like, oh, that's a Rosen auction. Those get continued 80% of the time. I'm not going to that one. I'll go to the ones that are being scheduled by Lou and Okuda, who always tell us what's going on and don't postpone them that often. They don't want to waste their time. So we've alleged those facts at the very outset. We've also pointed out the 28-day problem. So this initial notice was untimely. And
how do you respond to the case that I think was
with great ease, Your Honor.
All right.
The answer is he's citing the Weidemann case, and he cites the language of the power of sale in Sylvan. He says, we count the days. Those two provisions in both of those said X days or X weeks of notice, okay? So it doesn't say, it says after the expiration of X days of notice. So in that case, yes, if the notice is published on the 21st, that's one of the days of notice. But if you say X days from the date of the notice, we all know how to count from the date. And the way we can, if I say it's a week from today, we're talking next Thursday, not next Wednesday.
Mr. Bickerton, what about same facts that we have here, but only one continuance, claim or no claim?
We still think there's a claim, Your Honor, and the reason is for several reasons. Number one, the power of sale does say you've got to publish a notice. And getting back to Ulrich, what is customary? We show that three of these other law firms, they always publish when they postpone. Now, why are they doing that? That's real money they're spending. Those newspaper ads are not cheap, especially as we now have a monopoly of newspaper here. They're not going to put that out if they don't have to. They read this paragraph 22 the same way we do. We've got to publish another notice. You don't have to publish three because the power of sale is what you're following now, not the statute. You've complied with the statute. You've had your three notices. You've had your day of the auction, and you've orally announced. You've complied with the statute. But you've got to also comply with the power of sale, and that says you shall publish a notice, and you shall sell at the date and time stated in the notice. If you can't sell on that date, you better publish a new notice. So we think any postponement without the publication, and the legislature has said if you want to avoid a UDAP claim, do both. Do both. They didn't do that. They took the shortcut. They took the cheap one. And the public policy is there. And the UDAP statute and case law say you look to the public policy. What's the public policy? The public policy is to get the widest publicity, seek the best price. Is the thing that they did designed to achieve that? We suggest it is not. And it's a fact question for a jury to decide. If I orally announce to whoever happens to be on the courthouse steps, remember, these folks at this time, this financial crisis, there could be 10 or 15 other auctions going on. I mean, there's not a lot of buyers out there. It's pretty slim pickings. There's a lot of sellers because there's this foreclosure wave. And whoever's around, maybe there's no one. Maybe there's one or two people. You're going to reset it for a month or 2 months or 3 months out, even if it's one postponement, and never tell the public again, look, this is coming up to bid. That it could be unfair. A juror could say, looking at this paragraph 22, what it leads people to believe, even if it's ambiguous, looking at the practice of other law firms, this was unfair. And that's what Compton says. That's all we have to show you. It's unfair. And we may be wrong. Maybe a jury would say, you know, I agree with Mr. Wadsworth. They followed the statute. That's fair enough. But that's what the case law says we get to do on a UDAP claim. There's no safe harbor for them by complying with the statute. That is not the law. The Sperry and Spiegel cases are the cases that we in Hawaii followed in Rosa and the other cases when we adopted the federal standard. Both in Sperry and Spiegel, the defendant had complied with whatever the applicable statute was. Court, the FTC still found the conduct unfair. That is just a floor. And the last point I'd make in that regard is that the, I use it the sugar mill analogy. This statute was written when there was no such thing as a consumer. If you had said consumer to the justices in 1874, 1890, they would say, what is that? That's a modern idea that came about because we are essentially treated as fungible widgets, interchangeable by these large corporations because they can do nationwide projects and do a lot with many thousands of people. And the imbalance of power that came about required the enactment of consumer statutes that give consumers rights. So when we say, is following the statute fair? Yes, if I mortgage my sugar mill to you and you're going to sell it, I'm not a consumer, I'm a business. I know the risk, I'll take that risk. But is it fair to consumers to do it the way they did it in 1874? We say no. Under modern standards, under these policies that have come out in these cases, it can be unfair to a consumer, even though it might be perfectly fair to the owner of the sugar mill. So that is something we ask the court again to focus on. Look at the UDAP statute, but in looking at the common law statute, please don't limit this to just saying it's a good faith and fair dealing obligation. Ulrich is followed in many mainland cases. All of those duties are spelled out. Justice Pollack is correct. That is not merely a chattel case because at that time there was no distinction drawn in the statute. The duties are the duties, and they make sense for real property just as they do for chattels, and they're not particularly onerous. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to all of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.